Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. China has become the top maker and taker of underground ketamine. Siya Hatton sees the impact the drug has on the society and a place called the Drug Village, which is at the center of the trade.
Most karaoke bars seem almost exactly like this one. There's no general bar area for drinking. Instead, the entire place is made up of private rooms. Now, each room has a karaoke machine and a big TV screen that shows song lyrics and some seating, some sofas. Now, the room that I'm standing in is pretty gaudy, actually. It's covered in glittery, red glittery wallpaper and leopard skin cushion covers, and there's lots of odd futuristic metal sculptures on the wall to add decoration. Now, the point of the whole thing is that people who come here are in their own room, so when the door closes behind them, they can do almost anything they want. They're in their own private party.
We managed to get into one of those rooms, and we secretly recorded a group of young men out for the night. Their hair is slicked with gel, and they're dressed in nearly identical tight black t-shirts. Quickly, they turn on the karaoke machine, and they start warming up their vocal cords. Within minutes, a few members of the group produce small bags filled with white powder, ketamine. They use plastic credit cards to cut the drug into short lines, then bend over and inhale the powder through drinking straws. Over and over, they cut and inhale. They've clearly done this many times before. You might have heard of ketamine as a horse tranquilizer. It's still used around the world as an emergency anesthetic for humans. But in China, ketamine is more widely known as an illegal recreational drug. More than 1,000 people were arrested in a single police raid in a karaoke bar in southern China in 2013. Smaller operations are now commonplace. In May this year, police conducted raids in six Chinese cities simultaneously, shutting down an entire ketamine ring. On the streets of Shenzhen, ketamine's popularity is an open secret. In less than 5 minutes, we found someone willing to chat with us about it.
When we started taking it, we thought it was a lot of fun.
This woman tosses her long hair and smiles, even when acknowledging the drug's downside.
I used to take it with people I live with. Friends introduce it to other friends. We take it every day. Some people ran into problems taking ketamine. We know it can be addictive.
In just a few short years, ketamine's had a stunning rise. China's long had issues with both heroin and meth, the drug cooked in basement laboratories, made popular in the American television series Breaking Bad. But for decades, few could make ketamine under such basic conditions. But Chinese drug gangs have cracked the code. A few years ago, they figured out how to make large batches of the drug at low cost, manufacturing not just ketamine, but also the precursor chemicals that go into the drug. So cheap Chinese ketamine has shot up the ranks. Last year, it eclipsed heroin to become the second most common drug found in seizures and in clandestine laboratories. Later, we'll go undercover to investigate those operations. But first, low-cost ketamine is attracting thousands of young users. Many can afford the drug, but they can't handle the consequences of taking so much of it. We wanted to hear how some got hooked and what happened next. The doors at the Bai Yun Drug Rehabilitation Clinic are always locked. Families send their relatives with drug addictions here. Most of the patients aren't allowed to leave until they're clean.
I'm walking down one of the long hallways inside the drug rehab clinic, right past the patients' rooms. I've got to say, it really does have a bit of a prison-like feel to it. It's a bit of a cross between a prison and a hospital. Well, I guess it's both, really. The hallway is very long and quite dimly lit. And there are bars on all of the windows. Inside the patient's rooms, they're quite sparse. Each patient has a very small bed and a television, a row of hooks to hang their clothing. And there's really very little to make this place feel like home. I meet one of the patients. He's asked to be called Xiao Zhang, or Little Zhang, though that's not his real name. Xiao Zhang is 25 years old, but looks much younger because of his pudgy, smiley face, his hair spiked into a fashionable mohawk. Others have shied away from talking to me about their addiction, but Xiao Zhang is different. He's eager to explain every twist and turn of his story.
I first started taking ketamine because of a girl. I was secretly in love with her, but I was fat, and she rejected me. I was heartbroken. My friend told me this thing that could help me forget everything. I said no, but he said I wouldn't understand until I took it. I couldn't resist the temptation. After that, almost every night, we went to karaoke bars and discos. We took it day and night. I simply couldn't stop. And by the time I was 23, I started selling ketamine as well as using it. I even recruited younger boys to sell the drug for me on the streets.
If you left this clinic right now, how long would it take you to find some ketamine?
I would only need a minute. Just one phone call is enough. One phone call. Where are you? Wait for me. And then you get it. It's like an old scar. If you keep scratching it, the wound becomes bigger.
Xiao Zhang's story is typical. The clinic has 110 drug inpatients, and every year, more and more of them are young people under the age of 25, wrestling with a ketamine habit. In a strange way, this place feels like a university residence, though in this case, one that's full of restless and slightly bored patients. By the clinic's pool table, I meet another patient. He calls himself Li Min. He's quiet and shy. He looks downward as he talks. But like Xiao Zhang, he wants to explain ketamine's attraction. He first used it when he was just 17 years old.
I felt really good when I first took ketamine. My body moved in rhythm with the music in the bar. It was like floating. Afterwards, it felt like being drunk and I would throw up. I suffered terrible headaches later and couldn't sleep.
Li Min didn't like the drug side effects and he turned his back on it. He spent time in the army and then found a job as a community police officer.
My main duty was to patrol the streets and maintain social order. I handled cases involving a number of drug users. I was disgusted by their behavior. They'd often steal money to feed their addiction. I wrongly believed ketamine wasn't addictive. After all, I didn't touch it for more than 3 years. Stupidly, I tried it again in bars, and this time I felt the craving was really strong. Every day I had to take it. Each morning I wanted to snort ketamine, and at night the drug kept me awake. It totally screwed up my life.
Both the patients I interviewed seemed to have neurological problems. They often forgot what they were saying and stared off into the distance.
The biggest problem with ketamine is that we still don't understand how big a problem it is.
Wearing a dazzling white doctor's coat, the clinic's head physician, Dr. Yang Yong, seems to light up the clinic's shadowy hallway. We walk and discuss the drug that's taking over this place.
80 to 90% of ketamine users are young people. They're between 14 and 25 years old. They're looking for excitement and they're easily influenced by their friends. They have little resistance.
So how do you help these people?
If we discover a patient who has stomach ache or someone who has to go to the toilet every 5 or 10 minutes, it's clear that person is a likely ketamine user. We prescribe medicines to alleviate the pain and other medicines to help restore damaged nerves. More importantly, we need to offer psychological counseling.
That makes sense. In other parts of the world that have had big problems with ketamine, chronic users have major issues with their bladders because ketamine makes the bladder go painfully hard. A few years ago in Bristol, a port city in England, so many ketamine users had to have their damaged bladders removed that urologists coined the term Bristol bladder. Perhaps Guangdong bladder is next. But that leads to the question, who's profiting from ketamine's popularity? Who's making this drug? Ketamine can be manufactured anywhere. You only need the know-how and the right equipment. But in China, there's one village that's notorious in the drug trade. Locals call it the Fortress. At the end of 2013, an extraordinary event was broadcast live on Chinese provincial television. A 14-hour police raid on Boshu, a tiny village right at the tip of southern China. It started at 4 a.m. 3,000 paramilitary police descended in waves, sweeping through the village. They came on foot, by helicopter, and even speedboat. When the operation was over, 182 people had been arrested, including the Communist Party secretary of the village, the area's most senior official. 3 tons of meth were found, as well as piles of cash and gold, countless guns, and even an explosives factory. The raid took 6 years to plan. Police had been looking for meth, but they uncovered something they weren't expecting, more than half a ton of ketamine. They had little idea ketamine had also become a key product from Boshu. The village has been raided several times since, and each time new labs are closed and more people are arrested. We wanted to interview the police on the record, but they said no. They're proud of that big raid on Boshu, but they were clearly worried about discussing China's growing drugs problem. So we had to find a secret source. In the privacy of a hotel room, I met a police officer who was involved in the Boshu raid. He didn't want his real name used. I sat with him, watching a Chinese documentary about the raid.
We had response plans for all the different scenarios. Various teams knew which routes to take to go in. Some of the drug makers were the ring leaders or important gang members. We searched for the VIPs first.
Okay, so you knew the targets that you wanted to hit and you knew how you were going to go in.
Inside here, in this place, we knew we were going to find a lot of meth. The setup for ketamine and meth are pretty much the same. We knew this village had protection from higher parts in the government. So this raid was complicated. We conducted many investigations. We needed to know all the information because the whole village was involved.
That raid was successful, yes, but the police officer is less sure of himself when asked about China's wider problem with ketamine.
Judging by the number of young users, we're positive ketamine is on the rise. A huge amount of ketamine is entering the market and the drug is widely available. Its production is easy. People can make it at home.
But that's a relatively new development. Remember, for decades, ketamine was out of the reach of drug gangs. I wanted to get closer to Boshu, just to see what it's like after multiple police raids. It was time to pay a visit to the fortress.
We're just driving along the highway now to get to the village, and really there's a lot for us to think about. So usually when we investigate stories in China, we're on the lookout for a Chinese police who might not be so happy to have foreign journalists nosing around in their region. But on this story, we have to also think about villagers who might be connected to the drug trade who might not want us around either. So we have to look out for villagers and unhappy police. We're just preparing to go into the village now. We've heard varying reports about how dangerous it is. Some say that the villagers are still heavily armed. In the past, they've had guns and even grenades to defend themselves. Others say that the village actually has calmed down a lot, but we're not going to take any unnecessary risks. We're moving into another vehicle. It's a local vehicle called a tuk-tuk. And basically, it's a giant motorcycle with a metal van, a metal cart in the back where we'll sit, and it's covered in kind of a canvas top, so you really can't see into the back of the vehicle. And just as an extra precaution, because I'm the only foreigner in the group, I'm going to cover my blonde hair with the hood of my coat, and hopefully
I'll be hidden out of view.
好，谢谢你啊。
Okay, we've passed through the very opening of the village. We could see some sort of dirt roads, and it looked, from what I could see, looked to be really run down. There's piles of garbage on each side of the road. I could see a dirty canal that was just filled with discarded plastic, and it looked really putrid.
Soon, in the village center, the road smooths out a little, and I can see much larger homes, mansions several stories high, covered in marble, evidence of the extreme wealth funded by drug money. Many of these homes have elaborate electronic gates, also decorated with gold. As we drive through Bo Shu's narrow cobblestone streets, the locals turn to look at our little vehicle suspiciously. Clearly, we can't get more than a passing glance at the center of town. It's too dangerous for us to stop here.
Now we're just going down a little dirt road. It's very, very bumpy in this tuk-tuk. We're being jostled around and sort of thrown from side to side. And we're on our way to meet a farmer who's really been affected by the drug trade in this village.
This is my land, farmer Cai Jingsong tells me. He explains further, the ground is dry and there's no water. In the relative safety of Mr. Cai's fields, this tiny leathery man launches into his story. I used to have 8 cattle, but now I only have 5 because 3 died. They ate something poisonous, he tells me. Looking around Cai Jingsong's barren land, I can see that the earth is tainted with dark patches that look like dried pools of chemicals.
So Mr. Cai is saying that basically the chemical runoff from the drug production in the village just a few hundred meters away has basically come into the water. It's poisoned the water here, and it's also polluted the land. Can you show me? So he's just leaning down now. He's picking up some of the wet earth from the riverbed. And look, the bottom of it is kind of blue and black. So as we're talking to Mr. Cai, I think we should mention that he's very expressive man. He seems to gesture and wave his arms around every single time he talks. And especially when he talks about his land, he gestures in the distance a lot. It really seems to bring out his emotions. This issue obviously means a lot to him. This is his livelihood and his life.
I wonder if he was ever tempted to get involved in the drugs trade.
Me? Never. Once there were people who tried to persuade me to do it. But I just want to work in my fields. I've got my cattle. I'm afraid. Everyone tells me that 9 out of 10 people involved in the drug trade end up dead in the end. When people tried to persuade me to join them, I wished them good fortune, but I told them I don't dare do it.
Mr. Cai is living hand to mouth. He makes money picking up cattle manure and selling it as fertilizer. Until his fields are cleaned or he's allocated some new land, he has no prospects. We wanted to meet someone involved in the drugs trade. It took months to arrange, but one man agreed to talk to us, as long as we didn't name him. He told us he wasn't involved in actually making drugs, but his relatives, including his ex-wife, his current fiancé and her family, were all arrested in that big raid on Bo Shu.
The gentleman we're going to interview doesn't feel comfortable returning to the village after it's been raided by police so many times. So he's agreed to meet us in the mountains outside of Shenzhen. And we've actually come to an abandoned factory to conduct the interview. It really is pretty atmospheric. Feels like something out of a Hong Kong movie set, a huge abandoned cement building. There couldn't be a better place for an interview to talk about drug making and ketamine.
Together, we are looking at photos of Bo Shu's fugitives. More than 70 wanted criminals are still on the run. I lay out a series of police wanted photographs for the man to see. He points out the people he recognizes, but he doesn't like this exercise and keeps looking over his shoulder, even though we're in an empty room.
This is a big boss. This is another boss. This man's in production. And this guy helped sell it on to Shenzhen.
Okay. We're just in the middle of our interview with the man from the village, and he's so nervous. We're asking quite simple questions right now, but he's really nervous to talk about what goes on in the village, the families who live there, and the drug industry in general. We have to keep stopping the interview to kind of give him time to collect himself, so we're just on one of those little breaks right now.
Eventually, he begins to open up.
There were three major families who ran the Bourgeois drug trade. After the drug-making technique came in, the first family really worked together on it, and the drug profits were really high. One family taught another how to do it.
But Bourgeois' success became its downfall.
How easy is it to move a drug-making lab? If you have to move one, how quickly can you do it?
1 hour. In the past, when the labs were smaller, it took just 1 hour. But the more drugs that were made, the bigger they got. It was all too much. So the labs couldn't be moved in an hour anymore. The raid was a big surprise. All the telephones stopped working in a village because the signals had been jammed. People in nearby villages tried to warn people in Bourgeois, but the calls couldn't go through. When the villagers found out, some tried throwing the drugs into the sea. They did throw away a lot, but there were just too many drugs. They couldn't get rid of them all.
But ultimately, the raid did little to dent drug operations in and around Bourgeois.
Drug prices are still dropping because lots of drugs like meth are becoming easier and easier to make. There are too many people who know how to make drugs, so the prices are really low.
Those low prices are a real problem for those who are trying to get young people to stop taking ketamine. At the drug rehabilitation clinic, karaoke music is a constant. The clinic has set up a mini karaoke room with heavy velvet curtains covering the windows and a plasticky sofa. It's a tame version of the clubs where so many of the patients first encountered ketamine. Here, music is meant as a diversion. A young man sways to the music, dramatically clutching his microphone. One word from you and I was intoxicated, he sings. I never expected this. I'm holding back my tears. Xiao Zhang, the patient with his hair styled into a mohawk, meets me in a hallway near the karaoke room. He's feeling upbeat.
I've changed so much in the past few weeks. I never used to get up at 7 and go to sleep at 9. I never used to eat breakfast before. Even if I make one small step, that is still progress. Life is long. I can take my time. I am still young. Each small step is a small step forward.
In a few weeks, Xiao Zhang's hoping to leave. He's anxious to get out in the world again. A job's waiting for him at his uncle's restaurant in Beijing.
When I leave, I want to start again, both for myself and my parents. I need to change my environment. I need a new place to live. I need to stay away from my old friends, even break the connection completely.
He stops at the end of the hallway and looks outside, hooking his fingers around the metal bars covering the window. He's smiling. Xiao Zhang may have a chance of beating ketamine, but China as a whole is struggling, and it's exporting its problem abroad. Thousands of trucks snake their way into the entrance of the Wenjindu port. It's one of several crossings in the narrow border between mainland China and Hong Kong, a gateway to the rest of the world. This border is very important. It's where 60% of the world's illicit ketamine seizures take place, according to the United Nations.
can really see the challenge that customs officials face. In just the few short minutes I've been standing here, there really has been no let-up in the number of container trucks that have been flowing into the port area. I can't imagine the job it must be to search all of these trucks for illicit narcotics.
China is so worried about ketamine that it pushed for the drug to become an internationally controlled narcotic at the United Nations this year. Others objected. They say ketamine's a useful anesthetic in very poor countries. The petition was shelved until next year. By that time, China's problem with illicit ketamine might have spread even further beyond its borders, a cheap Chinese product with heavy consequences for those who can't give it up.
That was Celia Hatton reporting from the center of the drug trade of ketamine in China, otherwise known as Ketamine's Fortress Village. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Next week, the program will be returning to normal. As you're probably aware, it's Chinese New Year right now. So the whole news team of PCJ Radio International is actually taking a small vacation, but next week's program will be returned to as normal. If you wish to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. And of course, do let us know how you heard the program, if it was through shortwave, medium wave, satellite, or the internet. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.